One of the most beautiful sites on Earth. These are the Caucasus Mountains, and we are in a place called Valdai. As a matter of fact, it's come to be called Valdai because this is the Valdai Club. It's really very much different from most of the other conferences that people attend all over the world, because this one is made more to be a meeting of, well, intellectuals, and in my case, a pseudo-intellectual. So people come here so that they can discuss what's happening right now in the world. And look, this is happening at a time that is perhaps as important as any time we've seen from a transformational standpoint as the world goes. Why? Because we're seeing that there is a massive shift that is taking place from a unipolar world to a multipolar world, where we're seeing all of these countries that are ascending countries, obviously, like China, and in the case of Russia, a relationship that's been forged now that we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years, especially during the Ukraine situation. But now we see the rising as well of India, interestingly enough, almost forced in that position because of the so-called 50% tariffs that Mr. Trump threatened them with. We've seen the assertion as well of Brazil and Iran, which are now becoming parts of this whole BRICS idea, which is also extremely transformational. So what, as this is happening, people are coming together. We saw it when I was bringing you this show live, as you saw from the Beijing Cooperative Summit, and we've seen it in other places as well. But now we have it here in what is a different type of setting, a setting where people come together to figure out what are the next steps. And in that regard, here's where I'd like to start. I was asked to host a seminar today with a group of very interesting and very smart individuals. And what the question came down to is this, right? If it's true that we're essentially beginning what is a multipolar world, how do we know that that multipolar world that is now beginning, this thing that we're starting, how do we know it's going to be worth the crap? How do we know that this new multipolar world is not going to be as hegemonic as the last unipolar world that's led by the countries in Europe, for example? How do we know the Chinese are not going to assert their economic influence? How do we know the Russians are not going to assert their military influence and all of a sudden try and gain dominion of this operation? Well, what's interesting is during the seminar that I was honored to host, a bit of an argument broke out between the representatives who were there with Russia and China and India, who believe wholeheartedly, well, wholeheartedly is, I think, an overstatement on my part, who believe that this essence of this multipolar world that we're beginning is in fact a healthy, fruitful movement that is heading in a correct direction. Whereas the gentleman from Brazil and Turkey said, "Nyet, no, we're not necessarily convinced this is going in the right direction. We're not necessarily convinced it's working, and we've got some serious questions about it." Listen to this conversation we had during the seminar. I'd like you to see how the different opinions are of this what we thought would be a kumbaya moment, which turned out not to be a kumbaya moment. Here it is. Play that if you could, Gene.
How do you create a, make sure that the multipolar institute, whatever the hell it is, it becomes something which is not hegemonic as what seems to exist in the world right now? And for fear of not becoming hegemonic, do we just say, well, let's not do anything, let's keep things as they are?
Only insurance policy for a new kind of system, or let's say better system, is a software which gives some kind of guarantees based on kind of value systems. That's why I mentioned Gaza. I mean, imagine Shanghai mentioned in the first session, all countries came together. We weren't even able to hear from them what was happening in Gaza or Iran months ago. We need a kind of software. This can come from countries who are already forming something, BRICS and other forms. They need to come up. Actually, I was hopeful when the October 7th happened and the massacre started in Gaza, BRICS came out a kind of statement, first time they mentioned something political. But it gone away again.
I would say go BRICS and make it happen.
Yeah.
You know, this is very important because Brazil, just one example connected to the other part that I mentioned before. China wanted Brazil to get into the Belt and Road Initiative. Okay, it's very good in terms of receiving investments, but Brazil was afraid of being too dependent on China. So last year, during the Russian chairship, President Putin suggested the creation of an investment platform of BRICS, so that you can try to advance this kind of issues. And so just think of it, Brazil having foreign investment from BRICS countries that would balance the investment of the United States. Then maybe we could walk out of the room during the negotiation process. This is one thing.
This comes on the heels of the current discussion in the European Union with respect to the, what is that, $200 to $300 billion held by some banks in Brussels. And that's a lot of money. I think the rhetoric right now is radically moving towards a very risky and dangerous direction. It used to be the case about, you know, using the interests, the profits out of using their funds and to give it to Ukraine. Now it's pointed about confiscating, essentially, even though they call it reparation loan to Ukraine and eventually has to be paid by Russia. I think it's just tantamount to confiscation. And with that scenario in mind, I think, you know, China needs to think about the over $1 trillion foreign reserves basically sitting in the United States.
Example is a really good one. The idea that one country can freeze the assets of another country and then derive the interest from those frozen assets and then give it to the other country that it's in conflict with is absolutely crazy.
It's more than that. This is already happening, you're talking about. It's already happening. $50 billion, you know, to Ukraine coming from the interest proceedings from this 200 something billion dollars. Now they're talking about basically confiscating it, right?
I think the international system, it drifts toward order. But when we talk about confiscation of Russian reserves or unilateral Israeli policy to attack their neighbors, unprovoked Iran, Qatar, so even the US American base does not protect you from someone attacking your sovereignty. The US unilateral attempts to put pressure on the governments they don't like in Venezuela and elsewhere. This is trying to disbalance the system. And the system responding to this disbalancing will be militarization and strengthening of military arsenals. Israel wants to reach their own end of history, but it's probably the beginning of a new wave of, and the governments there will start to militarize and train the armies. The Saudi Arabia-Pakistan agreement in the area of security, where it was mentioned that the nuclear umbrella can be provided to Saudi Arabia by Pakistan. It's kind of curious course of event, which is also within the polycentric logic. All these disbalances should be balanced.
Well, guess what? It rains in the mountains from time to time, and it's coming down on us pretty hard right now. I want to introduce you now to three of the toughest guys I know. Who says academics aren't tough? Yes, they are. Let me start on the left with Professor Fabiano Melnicek. He is a professor of political science at the University of Rio Grande do Sul in Brazil. Así que, as we would say in Spanish, brasileiro. And it's a pleasure to have you, Professor. Thanks so much for being here. Also with us today is someone everyone knows if they happen to be into independent media. He is a superstar in independent media. His podcast does over 200,000 or so subscribers and millions of viewers every single day. He is Professor Glenn Deason, a Norwegian political scientist from the University of Southeast Norway. And here's another guy who usually needs no introduction because he makes the rounds wherever he can, proclaiming his truth about the real situation that has to do with the country he is from, which is Iran, Professor Mohammad Morandi from the University of Tehran. Gentlemen, I wish I could have more control over the weather. I thank you for your guts and your glory and for being here despite the conditions, and you look wonderful under those umbrellas. Let me start with you, Fabiano, because while we were having that conversation today during that seminar, you were one of the ones who pushed back on the notion, pushed back on China, Russia, and India, saying that essentially, and if I'm overstating, correct me, of course, that this multipolarity world that we are all bragging about and thumping our chests about is no panacea.
Well, that's not exactly my point, if I may. The idea is that, okay, we're talking about multipolarity, but what are the ways to get to multipolarity? There are different conditions that are conditions that different states have in the international system that allow for multipolarity or not. So in the case I was just quoting the situation of Brazil, Brazil is highly dependent on America in terms of foreign direct investment. So how can we pave the way to get to multipolarity and to smooth the way, not to create problems? That's why Brazilian diplomacy, they emphasize multilateralism instead of multipolarity, because they know that these things are different.
So is that why, Professor Deason, that we see, for example, China and India and Russia, for example, more inclined to give the United States a cold shoulder because they have less of an actual or even promised relationship with them?
Yeah, but it's also what multipolarity can offer because, well, if you have a unipolar system, one central power, as we had in the 90s, everyone has to fall in line because there's only one game in town. Now, in a multipolar system, it creates an incentive for an equilibrium. So, in other words, if the US puts more pressure on countries, you mentioned India before, to fall in line, then India will do the opposite. They will seek to diversify. Same as with the Chinese. If you cut off their supply to American technologies, they will set up an alternative partnership. So there's a force in the system, if you will, that punishes this kind of behavior.
Were you guys surprised to see India snap back so fast when the United States hit them with the 50% tariff? And if it's true, as what's, I think, confirmed to us today by the Indian ambassador during our seminar, that Mr. Modi turned down Mr. Trump's phone calls four times. Were you surprised to see that kind of resistance so fast? Go ahead, Professor Deason.
Well, not taking the call, I was a bit surprised, because it is in India's interest in a multipolar system to have good relations with all the main powers, including the United States. So I assume that they will want to keep them as an important pillar in the system. But I'm not surprised that they didn't fall in line, because if they would have done as they were asked to cut their ties with the Russians, then tomorrow the Americans will be back. So they cut off the Chinese, why not cut off the Iranians? And at the end of the day, they will end up like Europe, with only dependence on the United States. And then they're in a very difficult spot. Then they're forced to essentially show up at Trump's golf course and sign whatever paper he puts in front of them. And this is what the Indian wants to avoid. But in a multipolar system, they do want to maintain good relations with the Americans.
They seem to be playing the middle correctly, if anything, maybe leaning against Trump in this situation. Let me be almost cynical with you, Professor Morandi, and ask you the $60,000 question here is, you're the perfect person to ask based on what you guys just went through. I mean, Iran, of course, not you guys. Should India trust the United States and Donald Trump? How's that for a softball?
Yeah, I obviously, as an Iranian, I'd say no, because the United States, I mean, let's look at what happened to Iran just over the past couple of months. We agreed to negotiate indirectly with the United States, and then they started to conspire with Israelis to attack us during the negotiations.
Yeah.
And then just during the last week, we signed an agreement with the IAEA. The Europeans encouraged Iran to do so, promising to put back the snapback. And then Iran did so. Of course, Iran knew this would happen, but they went for the snapback anyway, and the United States said no. So the United States is not a partner that you can trust, you can deal with. The JCPOA itself, a nuclear deal that was signed 10 years ago, it was clear from the very beginning, even during Obama, that the United States is not going to abide by its side of the commitment. Abide by its side of the bargain. And the reason, I think, is clear because the United States, it's not just that it has power, but also because of the nature of the United States. It sees itself as exceptional. It sees itself as above the law. It has special privileges and rights, and it sees nothing wrong with that. So if one side, India, Iran, anyone else, China, violates a commitment, they'll get punished, and they will be attacked. But if the Americans violate it, it's normal. No one in the United States, the Western media, the opposition party, let's call it that, the Democrats or the Republicans, whoever they may be, no one is going to say, why did you violate your commitments? Because for them, it's nothing extraordinary. So you cannot really work with the United States in the traditional sense, as countries, neighboring countries or friendly countries do.
But you have nothing but sanctions from the United States. In the case of Fabiano and the case he's making for President Lula da Silva, they have a very healthy relationship that they have to guard. So if tomorrow the United States makes good on its promise and it bombs Venezuela, then is Brazil supposed to stop everything it's doing, end those negotiations, end that economic system that it has with the United States, and suddenly defend Venezuela? What will Lula da Silva do?
Brazil cannot do that. There's no leverage for doing that, okay? There's one interesting thing is that Brazil is a good partner of the United States, so we have investments from the United States, and the United States had surplus in trade with Brazil. Even so, they tariff us 50%. And there's no economical logic in that. There's a political strategy that Trump wanted to support former president that was his ally.
Right.
And so, and though we're suffering
that
sanctions.
Was a castigatory measure.
Yes, we are also suffering from Magnitsky law in Brazil. The minister of the Supreme Justice, he was sanctioned, and his wife. this is completely absurd. So I would say that as Iran, Brazil cannot trust America.
So what would it take for Brazil then to be in a situation where it wants to side with Iran, China, and some of these other countries, like, for example, India, and maybe lean a little bit away from its economic dependence on the United States?
Okay, this is the trick that Brazilian diplomacy has to do in this world. We need to have allies that are not dependent on America, but we are dependent on America. So maybe to pave the way and to make it smoother, we need to focus on mechanisms like BRICS, which is an interesting alternative when it comes to thinking about investments, thinking about trade in local currencies, and to diminish the dependence on America. This is one thing that I guess the Brazilian diplomacy is right in focusing on BRICS.
How big was that moment, Professor Deason? I saw you talking about it a lot. I was there in the Shanghai Cooperative Summit. The optics of seeing Modi and Mr. Trump and Mr. Xi together, I thought, doing a little bit of performance myself, the handshaking and the slapping on the back and the whole nine yards. How profound was that message, and did the world receive it?
Well, I think so, and the optics are important. They do communicate something, and that is, I think India then recognizes that as a hegemon is in decline, it would use its administrative power over the international economy to keep its vassals in place, or allies. But what India is doing is the exact opposite. They're recognizing that if the United States is putting increasing economic coercion over it, the main way to respond is to diversify. That means the supply chains it uses, the technological centers it cooperates with, the transportation corridors, such as what China is developing with the Belt and Road Initiative. So the banks it uses, the currencies, the payment system, so it can't be too dependent on SWIFT. I mean, all of these things which you could trust on before, when you had a more confident hegemon, which wanted to be play the role as a benign hegemon, all of this has to be reconsidered, because in a multipolar world, the former hegemon will act more aggressively with this administrative control. But other countries have the opportunity to find other centers of power. So it is a system which it takes a while to learn it seems, for at least for the US and Europe at the moment. But every time they put excessive pressure on countries like India, they will then lean in opposite direction. But So I think this is also very important, because it's very visual when you saw Modi go there to China. But he still looked for a balance. He didn't, for example, go to the military parade and lock himself into one grouping. He in a multipolar system, you don't necessarily want alliances. You just want to show that you can tilt in an opposite direction.
Yeah, they came to the party, but they didn't embrace, really. They're cousins, but not brothers yet, China and India, it seemed to me. Whereas the relationship between Russia and China seems more flourishing. Am I wrong to say that?
No, I think that's very, very correct. I think obviously India will keep this door open.
So how do we actually go from a yay, kumbaya, pound my chest, multipolar world, isn't this really cool, to actually making a difference in multipolarity and actually taking some of the power away from the former unipolar world, which is essentially NATO and the EU and, most of all, the United States. What is the thing that has to be done? I'm thinking in terms of, like, for example, what China's doing, selling off, dumping, essentially, $300 billion in U.S. Currency or Federal Reserve bonds. How important is that kind of thing?
Well, it's very, but I think we're in a transitional period because the West, especially the United States, still pushing hard to restore the unipolar moment. But that's only intensifying other countries' initiatives to establish more of a multipolar system. But it also has to be pointed out that the countries like India, they don't want it to be anti-American. They want it to be post-American. In other words, they don't want to
say that again.
They want to be post-American.
They
want a
post-American.
Yeah, well, anti-American means you're joining a bloc which seeks to weaken or undermine the United States. A post-American simply means you want to move beyond the hegemonic system, where the U.S. is one among many powers, which doesn't get to play the role to dictate to other countries. So they just want to communicate clearly, the Indians, that we don't want to join an anti-American bloc. We want to simply diversify power away from the U.S. And if they come after us, like they do with the tariffs, then we can lean a different direction.
That's smart. That's really smart, the way you just phrased that. I've never quite heard it put that way. Mo, what do you think of that?
I think that's how all of these countries felt about the United States. The Iranians, after the revolution, they said very clearly that if the United States respects our sovereignty, that we are more than willing to continue the relationship. Russia did the same after the fall of the Soviet Union. The Russians were literally, they were very eager to join the American camp. You couldn't even use different terminology for that. They went even too far, I think. The Chinese also, they weren't confrontational towards the United States. It's the United States that constantly is pushing countries, hammering countries, punishing countries, and that's what happened with Iran. As I just mentioned, we had two agreements, well, three. We had the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, in 2015. Then we had the negotiations that were taking place a few months before they struck Iran. And then we had the deal with the IAEA, and which amounted to nothing. So how is Iran or Russia or China supposed to see the United States as a friendly country? So no one is seeking animosity towards the United States simply because it's the United States. It's because of the behavior of the United States. And India is, I think, an interesting point. The Americans were cultivating the Indians tilted towards the United States, and then they were slammed with tariffs to punish them because of Russia. Then more recently, just a week or two ago, they sanctioned India's involvement in Iran, the Chabahar court. And then, of course, it was the issue of visas that was added to this. So India has to tilt in a different direction in order to preserve its own sovereignty, to protect its economy, and also its dignity. Because I think the reason why Prime Minister Modi did not answer the phones was because he did not expect to be slapped in the face the way in which he was by Trump, because the mood in India, the belief in India, was that the two were close friends.
What do you think, Fabiano, let me come back to you. Do you think that there is right now an understanding in the West that these countries that are gathering in places like the Shanghai Cooperative Summit have larger standing armies by a ton, larger population by a ton, better inflation levels by quite a bit, GDP growth 6.8 for India, 5 point something for China, 3.8 for Russia. You know, I mean, these are bigger numbers, better numbers. Do you think there's enough people who matter in the West who look at this, recognize this, and say, maybe it is time for us to not be such a bully?
I mean, since the beginning, BRICS was a threat to the Western hegemony.
But not
it's
like now.
Clear.
But
it's
not like
clear.
Now.
No, not like now. But since the beginning, they knew that it would end up bad for them. Okay, this is pretty clear. I used to work in a think tank in Brazil, and I used to receive diplomats from Western countries every week. And they were all worried about BRICS, but they didn't show that. They were asking me, hey, tell me everything you know about BRICS. And they're thinking, oh, but BRICS, you know, it's all about China. It won't work. It was 20...
tell me more, but I don't believe
it. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It was like 12 years ago. And so BRICS is the way it is, and it's important. So they are afraid that BRICS is going to create mechanisms to bypass this American hegemony. We're talking about the payments in local currencies. This is something important. If you think about the stock a grain stock exchange, which is something very important that BRICS might have, because BRICS they produce and they consume grain. So this is something that is completely unimaginable 20 years ago, and nowadays it's becoming a reality. But look, this is one very important thing about BRICS and other groups. They are going to be flexible. They're going to be informal. There's no formal ruling that is going to make all the countries abide for the same principle, because
it's not
they're based.
NATO.
They're,
it's
no,
what?
Not NATO. NATO. Not NATO. And they respect diversity. This is the first thing.
Yeah.
Second, all decisions are upon the consensus principle. So this is a different thing. And more, this is something that can protect the weak states from the pressure from the
but the bigger what's to stop the United? I think about this all the time, Glenn. I don't know. What do you think of this? What's to stop the United States, if they were really smart? Not that this is the right play, and I'm just a journalist, so I ask the questions. But what's to stop the United States from going over to China, whispering in their ear, or going over to Russia and whispering in its ear and saying, "Hey, come on over to divide and conquer," so to speak. Because right now they're sitting there. I am amazed as an American watching my country take on everybody. They're insulting Russia, they're insulting China, they're insulting India, they're insulting Iran, they're insulting everybody at the same time. I would think pick one off and put them on your side of the table. No?
Yeah, well, there's some talk already about this. I mean, replay the 1970s, that is to put the Chinese and the Russians against each other. But
and there Kissinger.
Kissinger's. Yeah. But there's been. But I think this is not a bloc system, and I very much agree with what was said here. That is, there's a logic. It's not anti. That it isn't. It's not necessitating to be in opposition to the United States. I mean, as you said, this part of the world has most of the public people, the territory, the resources. They have the technologies, they have the financial tools. So there's no reason why they shouldn't have more economic connectivity. It's an absolute gain, irrespective of America being there or not. If tomorrow America sinks into the sea, you still need this facilitating these things. So I do think that the U.S. obviously will seek to divide and conquer, and they do this. They tell the Germans don't trade with Russia. Russia don't tell to trade with Chinese. China, you know, don't forget you, or India, don't forget you have conflicts with China. And of course, you do want to cut off all them, separate all the major power in Eurasia, then you get to dominate it from the periphery. But again, this is a very imperialist way of thinking.
But I'm thinking of this guy right here. Thinking of this guy, right? Mohamed Marandi, Professor Mohamed Marandi. It's easy for you to say that. You're Brazil. It's easy for you to say that. You're Norwegian, but you have an understanding of both the Chinese and the Russo relationship with the United States. This guy and his country are not arguing with the United States. They're arguing with the United States' proxy, which is potentially, arguably, more powerful than the United States. And its name is Israel. What the hell do you do if you're in that situation where they can't win? Because they'd love to become friends with the United States, but in the end they're going to be in this perennial war with Israel for some damn reason. That's got to be the difficult situation for you. I don't want to overstate, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's tough, right?
You're absolutely correct. I mean, the reason why Iran was so eager to join BRICS and to join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization was because it helped Iran escape isolation, because the United States was putting pressure on all countries and continues to do so to marginalize Iran, because sanctions is like war. It's not very different from bombing people and killing people. You kill them in a way in which there are no explosions, but they're still dying. People lose their families, their jobs, people die of illness, they die of poverty, societies break down. That is the objective of these sanctions. We saw what they did to Syria. They destroyed the fabric of society so that they could gain control over the country. So for Iran, it was extremely important. And I would argue, even though the degree of problems that different countries have had with the United States have changed over the years, but I would argue that the reason why BRICS was created in the first place was because of U.S. behavior.
Yeah.
The reason why the Shanghai Cooperation Organization evolved to what it is today, and what the recent summit was very different from previous summits, was because of what the behavior of the United States.
Is Trump making that more so or less?
More so.
More
without
so.
A doubt. Yeah, yeah, without a doubt.
You agree?
Yeah.
Trump's making it more so. Yeah. He's pushing together that union.
Yeah, the irony is that he's like a catalyst. And he is, you know, For example, Iran and Russia are neighbors. Through the Caspian Sea, we're neighbors, and you know, the two countries, geographically speaking, are pretty close. We have done very little trade in the past with the Russians. We've never, our business people, they were Western-oriented until a few decades ago.
Uh-huh.
But now, by creating this wall between Iran in the West, Russia in the West, they've helped the two sides move towards building a north-south transport corridor. This was something that was discussed three decades ago, between the leaders of the two countries, but no one actually did anything about it, because they were complacent about, you know, there was complacency about the economy. They had to put money into this. Now the two sides are sitting and saying, why didn't we do this before?
Yeah.
So if it wasn't for the United States, we would not have this change in mentality. You would not see Russians, Iranians moving so swiftly towards China and looking towards Chinese technology. We would probably been more complacent even now as we speak, despite the fact that the global economy is shifting towards the East. We would probably be clinging to our old attitudes and our old biases about Western industrial technology and, you know, AI superiority. And because we've been influenced by Western media, and so we've traditionally believed a lot of what they say. It's only now that we're beginning to have new experiences and figuring out that actually the global South has a lot more to offer than we were told.
That's fascinating. And I think one of the things that stands out, not just the North-South corridor, but Siberia too, for me, I was floored by that, Glenn, that there's gonna be this pipeline between Russia, Mongolia, and China, which is going to essentially, as some have said, replace the pipelines that go between Russia and Europe. It's like, okay, you don't want it? Fine. We'll find another suitor, and they got more people who need it. To Germany's, you know, demise or suffrage as a result of this, no?
Yes, no, and this comes from Yamal. So this was, it's not even in Asian parts of Russia. This was meant to go to the Europeans, but we no longer want to buy Russian gas. We say, oh, we freed ourselves. So now.
But you're going to pay twice as much getting it somewhere else.
Yeah, so yeah, this means the industrialization, because cheap, reliable energy is really the lifeblood of any economy. So, we didn't think this one through, I think. But this is the main problem. And I think this is why Russia is going in the same direction as Iran. If you want to have a glimpse into the future, I think countries like Iran will build up a very powerful military defense to deter Israel and the U.S. and the West, while its economic connectivity will go to the East. The Russians will do the same now. They will build up a powerful deterrent, so this won't happen again, and all their economic connectivity will go to the East. And this is not great for Europe. And I protest what we're doing against Russia as a European. I see the self-harm in this. So.
I don't want to keep you guys out here too long, so we'll probably try and go another 5 minutes, because your mothers are going to get mad at me for getting you a cold or a flu. But I'm curious as to what your reaction. We're talking a lot about the apparent mistakes that maybe my country, the United States, is making in terms of its foreign policy. I see some things that are happening sometimes in Europe that are worse. I'll cite you an example that just happened within the last 24 hours. You know, our friend George Galloway was arrested, practically. He wasn't arrested. He was detained, humiliated, angered, and essentially accused of being a terrorist. And his wife, yeah, while going back. And I'm thinking, now, talk about optics, right? I don't know if it was you or you. One of you guys just posted something I saw on X when I was reading up on you. I think it was you.
That was me.
It was you. You showed a picture of the president of Syria, who was an actual terrorist, right? Shaking hands and meeting with U.S. military officials. And then there, side by side, is George Galloway, presumably being detained by European police, some would say thugs, being accused of being a terrorist. Wow, right? What the hell? Are we playing an upside down world? Is it the opposite game, Glenn?
Well, principles, they are well declining, I would say, and I wish there would be more of them. But this is also a problem of empire. That is, even people like Brzezinski, who kind of wrote a manual for the unipolar moment, he still recognized that it's very problematic to be an empire internationally and remain a democracy with the rule of law at home. So I think this is the problem, where were tearing away something important, which was worth preserving.
Freedom of speech. Yeah. Like, good gosh, it's where it comes from. Fabiano, I'll let you have your closing words.
Did I hear double standards? Just think about the example of Moldavia now, okay? So the members of the Russian Central Electoral Committee, they were not allowed to go to Moldavia to check the elections there. So it was forbidden. They couldn't go. Okay, they waited until the last minute and the visa was denied. But this is one thing. And so where's the problem with elections? Where's democracy?
It is an issue. And I, as a journalist, feel it, know it, and see it. And I've said this before. I have complete control of my narrative working here, and I did not have complete control of my narrative working over there. Something is terribly wrong with that picture, where a place that used to be called the Soviet Union, where the KGB would arrest me after this show, now allows me to basically have my own show. Have you guys seen me with scripts? Have you guys seen me with notes? Have you guys seen any marching orders from me? None. Final words from you.
You know, I think one word is enough to explain why the current order is unacceptable and unsustainable, and that's Gaza. And the genocide is being carried out in front of our eyes, day and night, 24 hours a day. Kids are being slaughtered, women, their bodies being torn to pieces. The Western media is apologetic throughout. They're trying to, then the Israelis and their allies, they're buying off TikTok or forcing TikTok to be sold. They're shutting down voices. George and his wife are intimidated. For, I think, the global south, there is no option. I don't know what's going to happen in a multipolar world, whether it's going to be better or worse, but we can't have any more of this. We have to move on. Hopefully it'll be something better, but this is just no longer acceptable.
Fabiano would argue, it's okay to move, but don't move so fast, right? Yeah. Wink, wink. I've always wanted to say this on television. I don't think I've ever said this before, but I'd like to thank Professor, to the three of you. Thank you so much for putting up with this difficult situation.
It's an honor.
And it's very nice of you guys. I know that it's not easy to come out here in this kind of situation, and I do think that hopefully your wives packed different trousers so you can change into something dry now. But really, thank you guys. I really appreciate your time. This has been a wonderful, wonderful discussion, and I thank you for sharing your insight with us, and hopefully we'll be able to do it again soon. And that's it for us. Thank you so much for being with us. We try to bring you the Sanchez Effect as a sharing of ideas. I don't think there's a better place to be able to share these kinds of ideas. And you notice we don't agree on everything, but certainly we agree with the respect that is necessary to have these kinds of discussions, which is what we do. It's kind of our mission here on the Sanchez Effect. Thanks so much for being with us. Also, I do have a podcast. It's called Journalistically Speaking. I'm a journalist. I believe in my skill set, and I think it's important. And of course, for those of you who want to have a conversation, I'm on X. It's called Rick Sanchez TV. And I see that tens of thousands of you are wanting to share conversations, and I'm sure many of you will have something to say about this conversation. Don't disagree with me, disagree with them. Just kidding. Thank you so much for being with us. And by the way, thank you for allowing us into your home.